Welcome to the Existential Hope Podcast, where we dive deep into the minds and visions of some of the world's most forward-thinking individuals. I'm your host, Beatrice Erkers. I co-host this podcast along with Alison Dittman, and today we're joined by Hannu Rajaniemi. Hannu is really a visionary in the realms of science fiction, and his work weaves together cutting-edge science with human imagination. He's also a biotech startup entrepreneur, and I would say for those craving to dive deeper into the ideas and themes that we'll explore today, head over to existentialhope.com. There you'll find a full transcript of the conversation and a curated list of recommended resources for further exploration. Also, there's an art piece really visualizing Hannu's positive vision of the future. Before we dive into the conversation, also a quick reminder to please sign up for the newsletter, The Hope Drop. It really is your gateway to staying updated with our latest episodes and insights and the Existential Hope community updates. So now, without further ado, let's welcome Hannu Rajaniemi to the Existential Hope podcast. Welcome to the Existential Hope podcast, and thank you so much, Hannu Rajaniemi, for being here with us. So Hannu, you're a Finnish-American science fiction author and biotech startup person, and I believe you're currently in California most of the time, but you come from Finland, and I know you've studied mathematical physics, and I believe you have a PhD in that, and I know that you also write a lot of sci-fi, which is very exciting, especially given your background. And yeah, we wanted to have you on this podcast because we're familiar with your writing, especially The Quantum Thief, which I think is your most recognized book, and also because there's a lot of interesting existential hope angles to discuss, I think, in relation to your work. And you were also a judge at our recent Existential Hope Transformative AI Institutions Hackathon, which is a mouthful of a title. But yeah, that was a very successful event, I think. So yeah, welcome so much. And thank you for being here. Would you like to just start with telling us about yourself? Who are you? What are you working on? And how did you get started on this? And I think both like your work in biotechnology and also your writing.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Beatrice. And thank you for having me. Yeah, I think it's no coincidence in terms of what I ended up doing that I was born in Finland. I grew up in a very small town close to the Arctic Circle. So the nights were a lot long and dark, especially in the winter, which meant it was very easy to see stars. So I think my interest in physics came first and foremost from wanting to build starships and figure out how to go to the stars, which also obviously meant I read a lot of science fiction. And the other thread was that because I was pretty much the nerdiest kid in town, I sometimes struggled to make friends, to have a social circle, to be accepted amongst my peers. I started running tabletop role-playing games in my early teens. And that did ignite also a love for storytelling and world building, which I think informed everything I did since as well. And so primarily I did then pursue mathematics and physics academically and ended up getting seduced by this mystery of how does mathematics work so well to describe the universe. Did a PhD in string theory, studied in the UK, did a PhD at the University of Edinburgh, and then got a little frustrated both with myself of having, I think, at the end of my PhD, come up against the limits of my mathematical talents. And then string theory itself as a field, it didn't seem to, and still doesn't quite seem to give us what we want in terms of unified theory of quantum gravity, and certainly doesn't tell us exactly how to build faster than light spaceships. So I wanted to do something more impactful, and I started a company with another string theorist. So that was my previous company where we set up business to solve mathematical problems for industry, and did that for a number of years with a team of about 10 other PhDs. And then simultaneously, I had this void in my soul, having lost contact with my role-playing games community in Finland. So I wanted to do something creative, and I joined a local science fiction writers group, or more broadly a writers group that included people like Charlie Stross, and more peripherally was also connected to Ken McCloud and Ian Banks occasionally, and part of that same circle of writers and voices, but many other gifted writers as well. I started writing short stories as a creative outlet during my PhD, and then that grew into a writing career. And then the mathematics startup had an unfortunate end, or at least end for me and my co-founder. We weren't very confident in ourselves on the business side, and brought on board an external CEO who then, together with their life partner, essentially maneuvered to take over the company and created a big conflict with amongst the founding team. And Stan, my co-founder, and I ended up walking away after about 3 years of quite fairly extensive drama. And then around the same time, I think there was a question later about like, when did I not feel optimistic? And this was probably that moment. So I had this, there was this moment when the company fell apart. And then at the same time, my mom was already at a really advanced stage of metastatic breast cancer. And it felt like I lost the future I had imagined, and my mom's future was being cut very short, and I felt very powerless to do anything about it. But then as I started to think about what to do next, I was quite naturally drawn to biology. I tried being full-time science fiction author, but I still crave that contact with more really direct contact with cutting edge science and technology, and also working on real life problems besides inventing fictional worlds. But what I discovered was, of course, this tremendous explosion we had in capabilities, in both in terms of reading and writing biology, and it had that vast, expansive nature that the night sky had. This was this sort of incredible range of new possibilities that clearly was going to redefine what being human is in the next century. So I decided to work on that, came to Silicon Valley for the first time, participated in the summer program at Singularity University, which brought a lot of these thoughts and threads together, and then ended up co-founding HelixNet, my current startup, as a result. And that had its own kind of extended path. So it does take up quite a lot of my time and energy. My partner in crime is Nikolai Reshenko, who did his PhD with George Church. And together we've focused on really building a kind of unified interface to the immune system using mRNA as the base layer. And that's now resulted in also some programs about to enter the clinic in the next month or so, and some quite exciting work on creating next generation cancer vaccines and many other things we can talk about. But I do find that the startup work does intertwine still with writing. I do try to still keep writing. I have a new book, Dark Home, coming out later this year. And then there's connections between the two sides that we can talk about. And I'm, of course, also a dad of a two years and five months old son, my wife, Donna, and that's another whole journey of dealing with the rapidly evolving complex system that plays a big part in my life.
Yeah, thank you so much. There's a lot to dive deeper into there, I think. I'll just start with asking you, I think, continuing on the origin track, what was it like coming from Finland to Silicon Valley? And I think especially it would be interesting to hear if you think, because we talk a lot about technology in this podcast often, and so what do you think if there's a different way of looking at technology and the future if you compare Finland to San Francisco?
No, that's a great question. I think in terms of the experience of coming to the Bay Area, suddenly everyone had played Dungeons and Dragons and was keen to nerd out about physics and computer science and all the other topics that I had grown up being obsessed with, and with a fairly limited circle of people I could talk about them with. Things improved a little bit in the UK, but there was an aspect of coming to rejoin my tribe in some way. And I think that this is, of course, the draw of the Bay Area that brings a lot of like-minded people thinking ambitious thoughts about the future together. In terms of of course, Silicon Valley does have this underlying big ambition about the future, which I don't think is as present in Europe in generally and or in Finland. I think there isn't. So Finland, of course, is a very well functioning, safe, modern welfare society, but inherent in that, in some sense, is some assumption that the future is going to look more or less similar to what it is today, that radical change is not going to happen. And therefore, there's some limits to the magnitude of things you should attempt. I think that's also changing. Finland does have a very vibrant generation of startup founders. Slush is this big flagship of that community for Finland. So I think that's also changing. But certainly when I was growing up in Finland, I did feel like a more static set of assumptions about the future that were kind of built into the societal fabric. But in the Bay Area, there's this long lineage of future being very different or new possibilities opening up, probably going back at least to the gold rush in the 19th century. And then in a more modern era, the original Silicon Valley, and then the sort of joint double helix of computer science and psychedelics and the kind of idea of human intelligence augmentation or radically upgrading our consciousness pharmacologically, which were practiced by more or less the same people, or certainly with a lot of overlap between those two communities, counterculture and computer science, where you can trace, you can sort of look at individuals like Stuart Brand as being one of the connected part of that connective tissue, how he created the Bible for all of that countercultural era, all those catalogs, but then also stage managed and produced Douglas Engelbart's The Mother of All Demos in 1969, that really demonstrated and laid the foundations of how we interface with computers today. And the Bay Area has a long history of accepting the possibility and embracing the possibility that not only is the world going to be different, but it has to be, or we have to build a very different world and shake up traditional structures. And I feel there's periods where that seems to have been less present. So like when tech became really big, maybe some of that mindset has been diluted, but maybe it's now coming back in some form. The sort of rise of AI feels like it's pushing people back into the weirder end of the spectrum. I'm finding that quite delightful, even though, of course, that also has an undercurrent of fear and worry about the sort of level to which we can control or make these new systems safe. So anyway, that's a long answer, but I think one, Bay Area has this long tradition of accepting it as a very radically different future, whereas, say, the Nordic countries have quite deliberately built this edifice of support scaffolds and support structures that are actually, should not be, of course, downplayed on what assumption that is, but does lead to some inherent inertia in if you have something that works, then changing that is scary.
Yeah, I think I share your experience. I'm based in Sweden also, and it's, I guess, that tradition of optimizing more for well-being, and it just makes you comfortable and not so much pushing the boundaries necessarily. I'd like to hear, because it does sound like you would be very busy because you're leading the biotech startup and you're also doing this writing. What's a day in the life for you? How do you get all these things done?
I made a choice a while back that I had to make some trade-offs in terms of social life and energy level management and creative work and the day job. And as a result, I now get up at 5 a.m. My creative time is between 5 and 7 in the morning before our son Casper wakes up. And so that tends to be now the time I get to meditation and writing and or other forms of creative work. And then Casper goes to preschool. I usually manage to get in some exercise at that point, and then it's on to whatever is the needed to do. I need to be done on the startup side, and then that carries on until the sort of early evening when we usually then try to have some kind of family dinner, and then I might do a little bit of work after Casper goes to sleep, and then try to be in bed ideally by 10 p.m. So it's fairly routine driven, at least when I'm at home in the Bay Area. When I come to Boston to work with our team here, it's a little less structured, but it is not a surface level a tremendously exciting life, but quite rewarding. So there's a lot of structure and routines.
Yeah, sounds like you need to dig out those structures and time to work on the creative part. I'd love to hear a bit more about your sort of creative process. I think you're the first sci-fi writer we've had on the podcast, even though Existential Hope podcast, and it's a pretty obvious connection to me there. But yeah, could you tell us a little bit more about your creative process? If you have an idea, how do you actually make that into reality? How do you transition from an idea to a completed work?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it does tend to vary a bit between stories and novels, and part of writing a novel usually is like some form of reinvention of what the process looks like. But I think the broad patterns are that usually there is some initial image or there's some initial collision of two things. So there might be a thing that I get curious about or that evokes some kind of emotional response, a new idea of some kind, which might be, I don't know, it might be something like what if vaccines could be infectious, or what would be some interesting failure modes for self-owning, self-driving cars or things like that. So that's one element, but it has to be combined with something emotional or something character driven. There has to be also some deep emotional truth or deep emotional question that idea triggers or amplifies, and that creates some tension with it. So it's never just about I want to write about self-driving cars. It is about I want to actually write about being unfaithful, or I want to write about being what is it, what happens in a marriage that goes wrong, in a world where there are blockchain implemented marriage contracts and self-driving cars, where there's like some, that's, and I'm referring to an older story of mine called Unchained, which you can check out if you want. But there needs to be this tension between deeply human and emotional. Maybe not, in this case, it's not like directly from personal experience, but something universal that I can relate to myself on some level. And then there's this process of, okay, let's explore that set of ideas. What connections does it trigger? And I do quite a lot of mind mapping I have this giant sketchbook that I draw like enormous mind maps in. Sometimes I also use little sticky notes to gather a lot of, might be scene ideas, they might be facts, they might be research things. Then I make giant clusters out of them. And I'm doing now some versions of this also digitally. But there's this sort of mind mapping and idea clustering. And for a short story especially, often out of those clusters, actual scenes emerge, and you can actually already derive an outline from that for the story, what happens or characters emerge. And I might then spend a bit of time organizing those thoughts in more detail, or because of the role-playing game background, I write almost like character sheets for the main characters and usually discover something new about them in the process. And then it's figuring out what the flow of the story is like. And I like these days the so-called snowflake method quite a lot, where you start like a one sentence summary of the story, and then you expand that to you iterate on that. So I might write 20 or 30 versions of one sentence versions of the story, and then pick the one that I like and expand that to four sentences or like four paragraphs. And you can obviously keep going from there. That usually gives me some idea of what the story actually it might end up being like. And then I write it. So I write a first draft. I just try to write a quick first draft. For short stories, I might write a draft of the whole story. And I like to write first drafts longhand. So I actually like to work with pen and paper at that stage, because it's computers. I just tend to find most of the time quite distracting. And I spend so much time staring at screens anyway, that being especially in that kind of morning quiet window, it's just nice not to engage with digital things more than is necessary. And I also find that there is a different cognitive feel to writing longhand. So the kind of continuous flow of the pen on paper gives you some inherent momentum, and ideas seem to pop up a little more naturally than when typing, at least for me. And then I type it up. So then that's actually already like an editing process already. So I might change it quite a bit as I not stick to the actual longhand version, as I put it into digital form. And then I might do a round or two of edits on the story. So there's a heuristic, and I forget now who originated this quote, but the writer said that there's three drafts. One draft is for you. The second draft is for the readers, and the third draft is for the haters. So you basically, the first draft is for you to discover what the story is actually about. And that I almost universally to be true, that I find out something new about the story that I didn't know going in just through the process of writing it. And then the core themes then can be brought out and amplified in the second draft. And then the third draft is, okay, there's little inconsistencies or fact-checking errors, or it doesn't quite work or click. And then you fix those in the third drafts. And that I found to be fairly consistent also with novels. So for novels, I follow a similar process, but on a chapter by chapter basis. So I try to at least, I wouldn't necessarily longhand draft an entire novel at one go. Some writers do. I think Neal Stephenson used to do this, but for me, the kind of unit of production is a chapter, which is really like a short story. And I am actually probably fundamentally a short story writer. I really like short story as a form, but some stories require the breadth and scope of a novel.
Yeah. I feel like there were a lot of pretty concrete tips in there that I think for anyone who wants to get started on writing can do. I feel very inspired about the handwriting part, actually. I'd like to try that.
I do want to emphasize that there's absolutely no right or wrong way to do this. And people do it in like many different ways. You don't have to outline, you don't have to draw mind caps. You can just sit down and write if that's what was work for you, or whatever tools come naturally. But yeah, it's interesting to play around with the process and see what works for you.
Yeah, whatever works. One thing that would be interesting also to discuss in relation to the work that you do in fiction writing would be thinking about like how science and technology interplays with that? Do you believe that speculative fiction has the power to inspire real-world scientific research? And you have your background in mathematics and physics. Do you think that's influenced your writing?
Yeah, starting with the second part, I think the way it's certainly influenced my writing is through, which is obviously why I'm also drawn to science fiction, is that mathematics really is this practice of assuming certain things to be true and then driving rigorously their consequences. So you start with a set of axioms and then you try to prove theorems that follow logically from those axioms. And writing a science fiction novel is a bit like that. So you make certain assumptions about the world and then you try to be faithful to their logical consequences. So you, even though the assumptions might be scientifically impossible, which I wrote a novel called Summerland, which is based on the assumption that some stranger Victorian ideas about the afterlife being the fourth dimension turned out to be literally true. And then that sort of world comes about as a result. So nevertheless, the sort of science fictional approach is to embrace those things as given and then try to imagine what sort of world emerges as a result. So I think that's kind of step-by-step first principles thinking, which is very deep at the core of both mathematics and physics, is certainly influenced me quite a lot beyond just the sort of subject matter itself. And then, yeah, in terms of the role science fiction plays, I think more fundamentally than even in science fiction, the great human superpower is to believe in imaginary things. It's what allows us to build societies and collaborate and also like aspire beyond what is possible. And actually, Michael Nielsen, who you should totally have on the podcast at some point, coined a term that I'll borrow from him, which he calls hyperentity, like an imaginary object that is so compelling that people actually want to build it. And science fiction certainly is a very good source of hyperentities. And there are some great historical examples. The one that I like to mention, which is surprisingly little known, is the atomic bomb, where H.G. Wells wrote a novel called The World Set Free. I forget now exactly the year it came out, but I think 1911 or 1914, that describes a suitcase-sized explosive device that can be dropped from an airplane, is powered by radioactivity, can destroy an entire city, and then called it the atomic bomb. And some years later, Leo Szilard, the great Hungarian physicist, read this book, and actually his initial passion for atomic power was to build spaceships. He wanted to figure out how to leave the solar system and find a power source for ships that could do so. But he was inspired by the radioactivity as a source of power directly from Wells's novel, and then he invented the chain reaction. And then together with Einstein, we're level to Roosevelt that kicked off the Manhattan Project. And later, Szilard explicitly gave Wells credit for inspiring him and getting him to think about these topics. So that's quite an interesting example. Then some more modern ones. I think the kind of debt of modern VR to Stevenson's Snow Crash has been quite widely acknowledged, which I think Stevenson himself finds amusing, given that Snow Crash is quite a dystopian future, and somehow there's this Twitter meme that's been going around, company announcement: at last, we have built the Torment Nexus from the novel, from the novel by the famous science fiction writer. Do not build the Torment Nexus. That does seem to be a bit of a pattern as well. In the case of the atomic bomb, the things that end up having impact may not actually be the optimistic ones. But then I could go on there. The other, maybe a more positive example, is the Motorola flip phone, a mobile phone directly inspired by the communicator in Star Trek. And that's also a design debt that was directly acknowledged by a flip phone designer whose name, you know, escapes me. But one interesting fact about that phone, early phone design, was that the Motorola also tried out a prototype of a phone that split open the opposite way from the way the Star Trek communicator opens, and nobody wanted to use it. So there, whereas the sort of Star Trek communicator flip phone immediately took off. So there is clearly some priming that happens through these imaginary objects in popular culture and how they shape what is to come. So I think, yeah, science fiction is a good source for these hyperentities and directly inspires people to build specific technologies. And of course, part of the power is that it lets you see those things from the inside. Like, you actually get a glimpse of what it might be like to use them. Even if the details are wrong, it's still something gets captured and transferred about the direct experience of what it might be, what it might feel like to have a startup communicator, or what might it feel like to be in a world where virtual reality is ubiquitous. So I think that fiction does tap also in these unique powers of running world simulations and simulations of other humans that and other entities that we all have. And so yes, it is a powerful tool for shaping the future. I think the challenge is that it's not a very predictable process. I actually don't really think this can be done deliberately, or it's at least I'm not aware of any examples where it has successfully been done deliberately. And there was an attempt. Arizona State University had this program called Project Hieroglyph. And I guess Neil Stephenson used the term hieroglyph, or what I was referring to as Michael Nielsen's hyperentity, like a compelling science fictional art. And that project did produce an anthology where the goal was to engineer hieroglyphs. And I did not find them terribly compelling, or somehow none of them ended up being very sticky. And I wonder if it's something about that again, these are things that have to pop up from the collective unconscious somehow, that there's this organic process of hyperentity cultivation that is inherently unpredictable. And certainly the thing that I can point to in my own work that has seemingly inspired others to try to build some form of it, is in the quantum thief, there's this concept of gigawatts for privacy settings for reality, of giving you very fine-grained control over all the data that is recorded about you or captured about you. And there's a number of folks who have sort of written papers on how this might work. And there are some blockchain schemes that take inspiration at least from Gigawatt. And I think there is actually one project that is actually literally called Gigawatt. But the way that came about was purely from storytelling considerations. So I actually did not. I was aware of the debate around data privacy and so on around 2009 when I wrote Quantum Thief. But actually what I wanted to do with Quantum Thief was to write a detective story set in a post-human future. And therefore the challenge there was that in a society where with ubiquitous sensing, with ubiquitous nanotechnology, everything that happens would be recorded possibly at the sort of level of individual brains and thoughts and so on. So how on earth would any kind of detective story even make sense in that world? Or where would the conflict be? And the answer was to invent a society where privacy was more highly regarded as a value than preventing crime, and up to a point at least. And then obviously that required some infrastructure for sort of the privacy aspect to be reinforced and built into everything. And that's where Gimbal came from. And I think this is actually a relatively common pattern with the sticky things in science fiction, where another Star Trek invention that doesn't exist in reality yet, but has certainly inspired a lot of work in quantum teleportation and things like that, is the transporter. And Gene Roddenberry invented the transporter because there was no budget to show a shuttle landing on a new planet in every episode of Star Trek. So I think it may be that the interesting hyperentities or science fictional artifacts actually come from some kind of creative constraint, or again, there's that sort of human or emotional aspect, or the type of the narrative aspect that is needed to make it sticky, to make it something that we can relate to also on an emotional level, and that sort of has to emerge not just from technological speculation, but some kind of emotional relationship of what that looks. Entirely possible that there could be more sophisticated forms of hyperentity engineering or hieroglyph engineering, and I'm kind of curious where we get to with generative AI on those kinds of things. But that's my main caveat, that science fiction might shape the future, but not predictably or systematically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very interesting because oftentimes when we have like discussions, realpolitik discussions or something like that on Existential Hope, oftentimes people will say that we need more positive visions of the future in general, and just to get people excited about it, or at least not be scared about it, which I think is the case for many people these days. But, and also just to make it more concrete, because then people can get excited about what makes them excited and be willing to work on creating that future more. We are doing a thing like a world building challenge right now with the Existential Hope Project. And so that's one way of exploring it, ideally trying to build out a world of a positive state in the future. We're playing with the year 2045 and trying to think of what's a version of this world where we've gotten to a state that's a positive vision of the future, not necessarily like a utopia or anything like that, but just like things are looking pretty good. And so that's something that we're experimenting with now The idea being that, oh, maybe we can use it to like back cast and think of how did we get to that positive vision of the future. So yeah, I don't know. It's definitely something to play with. But I'm going to hand over to Allison now, because yeah, she's going to ask you more about like the concrete, like existential hope question. So I'm sure you'll get to dive into your vision of the future. So yeah, handing it over.
Yeah, I learned so much. I had no idea about Unchained. Really happy and excited to dig into this more. But I think just do the little bridge into this section, which is usually just, you've talked about many different kind of like technological capabilities, and you talked about many different kind of like societal changes and different tropes that are just like inherently interesting to folks. Could you perhaps, if you draw on those or what others that you haven't mentioned yet, draw a picture of an existential hope future that you're currently excited about? Feel free to use some kind of like dark home memes in there, or maybe even some of the immune computer interface stuff. But yeah, could you like, what's like a modern way to think about positive futures in your current setting?
Yeah, so I guess maybe to make this explicit and connected to also things I'm working on outside writing. So really, a novel that I finished writing recently is called Dark Home. And so D-A-R-K-O-M-E as in genome. And it really deals with this question of who should control our biology? Who should mediate our ability to manipulate biology? Should it be us? Should it be individuals? Should it be someone else? How do we do it safely? These capabilities are emerging almost inevitably and present incredible possibilities, but also threats. And the kind of, and so it's not necessarily, parts of it are meant to be certainly optimistic, but I think what I'm really interested personally in are complex futures, like futures where there is some tension between two opposing forces, whether those are human forces or technological forces or philosophies, or even like more multipolar polar things where the answer is unobvious, but the questions are interesting. And I think I do find the question of our relationship to biology and our sense of biological self one of the most interesting ones that is really, I think, not discussed enough, where we are on the cusp of being able to re-engineer humans quite extensively in terms of our fundamental biology. So there's the one part of that certainly is the increased capability in editing and engineering and sort of germline editing. But actually what I find more exciting is this ability not just to alter unborn children, but to actually somehow upgrade or also alter grownups, or to change their biology more transiently. And that of course leads us to technologies like mRNA, which is making it possible to not permanently, but for a period of time, express almost any gene, synthetic gene in the human body that we can imagine. And right now, of course, we are in a world where mostly that kind of work is done in quite strict regulatory frameworks by large companies, where you have to go through a drug development process to get anything deployed into humans. And that process alone can take many years. But at the same time, a lot of the key technologies are becoming so democratized and available that people are just starting to self-experiment. And there are people like Joe Zahner, who had very publicly CRISPRed himself on stage, et cetera, where, and then on the more inspiring side, there are patients with rare genetic diseases whose families are taking things into their own hands and trying to develop the DIY therapies. There are patient communities even testing DIY cancer vaccines. So it's not necessarily always going to be a sort of just in the realm of tightly regulated capitalist organizations where this work will happen. And if you think about the nature of biology itself, our bodies, our immune systems are not kind of monolithic, centralized organizations. Usually a kind of old idea is that any product is always going to be somehow isomorphic to the organization that builds it. If we want to essentially build much more powerful biological tools, the organizations that built them might end up have to end up looking more like those biological systems, more decentralized, more fluid, wherever you can have individual ideas that get exponentially amplified and so on. So what Dark Home really is about the collision between the kind of very centralized, almost like Apple for biology vision with a kind of Linux of biology vision and the tension between those two. And actually one thing that surprised me a little bit was that As I was writing it, I found myself becoming more sympathetic to the Apple vision also. My perspective shifted a little bit, and that the that I'd come into it originally very much from like the hardcore, let's do a free for all libertarian biohacking world, and it's going to be more appealing. And to the main character, it absolutely is more appealing. So she has a genetic disease that she's trying to cure. But then getting deeper into this world, I realized actually there are strong arguments you can make also for sort of walled garden ecosystems that aren't necessarily worse in all ways. So there's some synthesis that lies between those two that I'm curious to see emerge. This is one of the key questions for me, where I would obviously like to see that is also at the heart of the positive futures that I would be imagining currently. So how do we upgrade our biology, and who decides who can do it and when, and how do we do it? And obviously there are just some concrete health problems that we should solve. There's 50% of us get cancer. We should solve that. Aging is also pretty annoying, and we are getting closer to having the tools to address that. But then there is actual sort of human enhancement and expanding what is possible for humans. And there's this sort of deep question of with AI, like how do we turn AI more into intelligence amplifiers rather than autonomous agents? And one route, which was highlighted and debated, discussed extensively at the hackathon as well, was brain-computer interfaces. And if we want mature brain-computer interfaces, we're going to have to solve a whole host of biological problems, which at the core of which is actually, how do we get the immune system to accept foreign parts, both biological and technological parts, and really extend not only our cognitive self through coupling with AI, but also the biological self. And this is why I've been so obsessed with the immune system, that the immune system really defines the boundary between self and non-self and maintains the homeostasis of this kind of complex collection of organisms that we are. So we need to, if we want to expand its boundaries, we need to start talking to it in a more high bandwidth fashion. And in the same way that we've now had this, and again, going back actually to the lineage of transformative Bay Area thinking, there's this lineage of human intelligence augmentation going back to Engelbart and at least and before him, of the bicycle for the mind, of creating ways for us to interface with computers to augment our intelligence. I think we need to do the same for the immune system. And there are some deep analogies there of these are the two information processing systems that our bodies have that sense and act on signals from the outside world. And of course, they themselves, brain, the immune system, are both intimately interconnected, but the genome, the immune system also in a way is the guardian of the genome. Like if we try to add things to the genome, it'll recognize them as foreign. So we need some kind of immune computer interface to get into, to at least expand the space of human possibilities. And then I think to build that, we probably need some organizational and even philosophical if thinking. And like, I think you had a question about you catastrophe. And I think for me, this may or may not be related to immune computer interfaces, but for me, a new catastrophe would be the emergence of some kind of social movements or ideological movement or a religion, maybe like something that radically shifts our thinking in relation to both the natural world and ourselves and the things we're building towards some kind of more mutualistic view of flourishing which sort of carries some kind of, and I think indigenous wisdom probably has quite a lot to offer to because we do have thousands of years of human history of human societies living together and dealing with large complex systems in nature and interacting with them. And we're now ending up in a situation where there are these vast systems that we've created ourselves and are getting increasingly sophisticated and which we can't really control, yet our existence depends on them. And to the point, and which are, like, climate is doing such unpredictable and extreme things that we might actually have to start modifying our own biology just to be able to adapt, not just to other worlds, but to Earth itself. Anyway, I think all that is to say, I think there is also social and movement and activism and dimension to whatever positive future we may end up in. And I explore that a little bit in Dark Home, but certainly don't have necessarily very concrete proposals on what we should do. But I think we need to definitely explore. And I think obviously this was, again, the point of the hackathon. What are organizational structures that can support positive transformation or flourishing? So yeah, That was very incoherent, but any follow-up questions on that?
Yeah, actually three, and then you can kind of decide where you want to take it. One is, I think, just harking back all the way to when you mentioned the bit on Apple versus free-for-all, especially about biologic enhancements, for example. Is there possibly also a third way? For example, Apple, the Apple version of this kind of like biologic enhanced future would be have potentially like power centralization problems, privacy problems, possibly. And then on the other hand, the free-for-all version of it would really have this kind of like problem of like maybe bio-risk and small kills all scenarios, like the obvious kind of like usual trope or like the juxtaposition. And could you imagine also like a decentralized world in which you have like multipolar privacy-preserving monitoring of different agents monitoring what other folks are doing and to just check that there's not like an incredible bio-risk coming along? That was one question. I don't know if you want to...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the multipolar version is very possible. And then I think there's like some kind of app store version where it's not all centralized, but you have shared infrastructure that and some with some safeguards. So if you want to develop a therapy for your rare disease, you can access a bio Apple infrastructure and tools, and maybe they even support you in running clinical trials. So if you do, again, I guess one technological element that, as you described about DarkOM, is that on the sort of Apple side of things, there's a company called Aspis that has built this mRNA wearable that everyone who's not part of the DarkOM movement, which is the free-for-all movement, has. So your immune system gets constantly updated against any new pathogens in the background. And something that happens, a slight spoiler, actually, it's a slight spoiler, but not a major spoiler. There is a point in the novel where Aspis then starts to consider opening that platform up to third-party developers, where you can then potentially use all their infrastructure to develop your own therapy for a rare disease. And then you can run a virtual trial because everyone already has the device. So you just need a laptop and an internet to run a human clinical trial. And they obviously give you design tools and so on. But then that nevertheless still allows them to monitor whether anyone is doing anything truly malicious. So, and there's some real life signs that those kinds of things might become possible. So Peter Marks, who was one of the chief architects of Project Operation Warp Speed, and who is a very forward-thinking FDA official, head of CBER, the biological division of the FDA, has been proposing ideas around so-called platform technology approvals that you might be able to, for example, leverage plots of leverage safety data for certain kind of gene therapy vector from that has been already generated by others who are developing a new therapy, and then you might not have to do that all that from scratch, and then similar for some of the more recent mRNA technologies. So I think this kind of platform thinking might become actually more mainstream as our biological technologies advance. So yeah, I think we'll probably naturally end up in some kind of synthesis. Although I it would, just to shift the Overton window, it would be still interesting to see more biohacking happening. So it has not been, at least in the mainstream, very much discussed in the last few years. But yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely been discussed in some subculture. How does this, I guess, like this future in particular, like really interface with your work at Helix Nano? Is there any kind of like mutual inspiration either way, or how does it show up in your everyday life?
No, this has now become like the dark vision of this mRNA wearable has now become more or less a blueprint for what we're building, or more broadly, this idea of an immune computer interface. And in fact, you can take our internal projects, you can map them to some of the key components that need to be built. And this also
on hyper object.
Yes. Or like an internal hyper entity. I think we'll be a little more open about it and hope to inspire others, I think, to participate as well. But yeah, the hyper entity is becoming real.
How could people participate in it? Like, is there already like kind of an update or something or anything that?
So I think so it could be very concrete about what we're doing currently. So so there's some foundational mRNA technologies that we're building. So one layer is actually kind of almost like the transistor level of how do we actually make mRNA chemically that is tolerated by the body better to enable very rapid, frequent dosing, this constant updating. If you like, so we've developed next generation mRNA chemistry that is actually going to be in humans for the first time in about a month that enables radically higher and more frequent doses than the current mRNA technologies. Then we have various tools for more precisely directing or amplifying immune responses against key targets. And then we have some machine learning driven vaccine antigen design technologies where we're basically trying to do things like overcome the reluctance of the immune system to attack certain cancer targets that it treats as self. So like the opposite of what I was describing earlier for brain-computer interfaces, we might want the immune system to accept some new thing as self. But there's also a situation where we want to go after something that it mistakenly treats as self, a cancer cell. So we really want to build next is closing the loop from being able to gather information about the immune system and what's happening, for example, in a patient's tumor, to then custom designing RNA vaccines that go after that. So like a disassembled version in a way of that mRNA immune chip. So one concrete example is cancer prevention. There's this technology called liquid biopsies where you sequencing to detect circulating tumor DNA in a patient's blood. And this might actually, you might get a signal even years before there is an actual developed tumor. And right now there's no treatment. There's nothing really that can be done except lifestyle changes at that point. But we want to be able to, at that point, then give that person an mRNA vaccine that is targeting whatever has popped up. So that's the sort of one part that we're very interested in collaborating with others on how to, on the liquid biopsy part and also gathering information about the kind of full spectrum map of the immune system. And then, also like thinking about how these technologies could be integrated in, not necessarily yet on a wearable chip, but like how can we move closer to something that combines a lot of these capabilities in a single, maybe a microfluidic device. But I think the broader idea there is that I just want this hyper entity of immune computer interface to be more known, because the more people think about it, the more different angles we'll find and new forms that will emerge. And I think at the core of it is the idea that besides the brain, we have this other information processing organ that is very powerful and which we now have tools to talk to in interesting ways, in which we can augment just with technology, just like we can with our brains. And we'll try to, with Helix Nano, create some example of that, but I'd love to see 100 other efforts to build something like that.
And if you think of perhaps like Dacom as like a more advanced future vision, and then Helix Nano as like one kind of like project that is like working towards at least a future in which this is definitely becoming more of a prevalent reality concern for society, then what are like a 5-year out plan or something? Or what's a 5-year out capability that would make you feel like, okay, we're like on track for building a future in which we have something like an immune computer interface, whether or not you guys created or someone else, like what's like an intermediate vision?
I think that's a great question. I think like a five-year time scale, like 100,000 patient cancer prevention trial, where we or others demonstrate closing the loop from here's a patient, here are 100,000 patients that we monitor for early signs of cancer, and then let's see if we can actually prevent them from getting an advanced tumor. To demonstrate this closing the loop of reading information from the immune system and then writing something back, helping the immune system to deal with whatever has popped up. I think that would be a strong signal that we're on track for some sort of full spectrum immune computer interface.
Love it. Great. Is there anything else in this like future of existential hope that we didn't get to? I love, for example, when you mentioned both the kind of like Unchained, but reminded me a lot of it was work on like split contracts, for example, which like basically are half automated, but then have an intermediary arbitrator in the loop, so that if people like after half of the automated contract are not quite sure anymore about whether or not they, for example, want to continue the marriage, they can have like a human arbitrator come in. And then I think when you mentioned the, I guess like quantum thief, hardcore privacy management and like very flexible and like individual privacy management, it also reminded me of the opposite trope of that was also in Transparent Society with David Britton, where he went the opposite way. It was just like, if we really have really good monitoring and mutual monitoring, then we just may end up in a society that doesn't care about privacy at all anymore. So I think it's really interesting to play with these tropes in opposite ways. And I wonder if you just want to, in the last 2 minutes that we have, throw another one into the ring that people can consider. And it's totally fine if you don't. There's other questions too, but
I think I have not actually thought about privacy stuff recently that much, although obviously it's highly relevant, but to throw in a thought I've been, or a thread I have been thinking about is the idea of AI sentience. So what if we end up in a world where, to go into an extreme, turn up that volume to 11, like what if we end up in a world where we create uncountably many sentient beings? And what moral rights do they have? And how do we deal with that? So I have been working on a short story related to that, where in a kind of very positive future, actually more broadly, but after climate change and other issues have been solved, that the next kind of frontier that incites activism are sort of AI rights, where suddenly people realize that these countless billions of agents that have been trained in vast simulations that are effectively being tortured and dying and perishing in uncountable numbers have some moral weight, And therefore that entire exercise is stopped. And so now you end up with these sort of billions of kind of frozen mines in cold storage. And then there's people who take them in as rescues of who try to give them, for example, a physical body or a simulated environment where they can try to, and then often they are like very broken and dysfunctional. So there's a, anyways, that's not saying we're necessarily going to go there, but I think you're spot on that interesting futures do appear when you try to go to an extreme extrapolation of whatever trend is already visible. And in that sense, obviously, science fiction is also always about the present day on one hand and reflecting our present day fears and concerns. But I find the question of AI, our kind of relationships with AI and thinking about it from not just from stance of there's this super powerful demon that we have to cage, but actually an entity that we might have to treat with some dignity and care, and that might lead to a better outcome. And we might have to do that unless we are willing to sacrifice some very kind of foundational principles around sort of sentience and morality that we currently seem to hold.
It's so interesting that you bring that up, because we just had Jeff Sable for a seminar, and he's working on basically digital minds and like the possible more people around them. And I think one thing that he pointed out, which is interesting, is like over-optimizing versus under-optimizing on assigning sentience or consciousness or agency, whatever is a relevant factor for moral patient, too early versus too late. And he made this interesting parallel that you also drew to like animals just now. We should probably aim for false positive to some extent, or like one could think that, just because historically we haven't been really good at distinguishing and assigning sentience and consciousness to animal minds where it may have mattered. And so we can assume that we may have a negative bias towards that here. And so maybe we should over-optimize on that, on assigning it earlier. But on the other hand, there may be so many of them, and they may also be like so like rich in their conscious experience that like we may get totally Pascal's wagered if we do. And they may also, because they're different to animals, they have natural language, they can tell us that they're conscious, and they may trick us in different ways that don't actually exemplify actually like whether or not they're conscious. And so anyway, there's like concerns either way. But then he also thought maybe AI companies are not incentivized to have their large language models tell you whether or not they're conscious, because that may shut them down earlier. Anyway, that lots of a whole host of factors that I think we have to wade into now. And there is really practical work on this being done already in terms of like evals for sentience and so forth. That's definitely something that is not even that sci-fi anymore. Like we are starting to think about this now, and we certainly have to. Okay, we have to wrap it up here. Unfortunately, I could go on this for like days and days on end. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Do you want to leave us with any final words about how people can find out more about your work if they're interested? Thank you so much. This was like really inspiring.
Thank you so much. Thank you. This is a great conversation. Yeah, the easiest way to find out about my work is on Twitter. I'm Hannu on Twitter, H-A-N-U, just my first name. And I'll be posting some stuff on the topics we talked about in quite soon.
I strongly recommend following him. You have a really wonderful Twitter. It's full joy. Thank you so much, Hannu. And yeah, I hope to welcome you sometime again soon.